You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is John Rowley. John, did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Yes, it seems to be challenging, but Owl is the key. Rowley.
Yes, yes, yes. I usually check that out ahead of time, but you know, some days I forget. So the way we start this show, and the show is basically modeling how do we get to know each other when we don't know each other as, you know, kind of persons in this community. Although you are a well-known figure in this community in a formal role.
That's right.
And also in a more personal role just because of who you are. But again, the question we start with is, who are you? What do we need to know about the qualities you aspire to live, the labels you wear, or your life to start the conversation?
Oh, sure. Thanks. It's nice to be here. 58 years old. It seems every year that gains significance for whatever reason. I do feel like I'm getting wiser as I'm getting older. So I mean that in a appreciative sense, not the denigration. and particularly my gerontologist friend will appreciate that, who's always on guard for aging jokes.
Yes.
I've actually just spoke last week to a group of judges about aging and trying to focus on the fact that we don't have enough examples or conversation about aging, and a lot of us are actually going to live for a long time.
Right.
So I feel like I'm really kind of looking forward to going forward with that, adapt in a positive way to that. I'm 17 years as a Tompkins County judge. This term will end in 2020. If my wife has anything to say about it, I'll retire. That's not on my plans currently, but it's certainly on the horizon at some point. And even that whole reality of ending this part of it, especially such a public and such a challenging position, that ending. There is mandatory retirement in New York State for judges at age 70. Mm-hmm. So one way or another, it's coming to an end within 12 years.
Right.
We've got two sons, and I've got a wonderful marriage with my wife, and we've had a small farm, which we have kind of are transitioning over to a more of a state would be the wrong word, a farmette. We've gotten rid of the farm animals. So I enjoy a lot working outside. I keep bees, those kind of things. So a lot of different interests.
Well, that's neat, and we will take off in a number of different directions, I assume, as we go forward. So you brought some music with you. What do you want to start with?
It was fun picking out music. I don't have that opportunity often, so I started off with "Everything Is Broken" by Bob Dylan.
Do you want to say anything before we play it or after?
Let me say it after.
Okay.
Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols, broken heads, people sleeping in broken beds. Ain't no use shoving, ain't no use joking, everything is broken. Broken bottles, broken plates, broken switches, broken gates, broken dishes, broken paths, streets are filled with broken hearts, broken words never meant to be spoken, everything is broken. Stubborn, turn around. Something else just to hit the ground. Broken kettles, broken souls, broken buckles, broken laws, broken bodies, broken bones, broken voices, and broken phones. Take a deep breath, feel like you're choking. Everything is broken. Thank you. commonplace. Things fall to pieces in my face. Broken hands, I'm broken plows, broken treaties, broken vows, broken pipes, broken tools, people bending, broken rules. Hound dog howling, bullfrog croaking. Everything is broken.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is John Rowley. So, John, looking back on your life, what are experiences that have been really important to shaping the life that you value living today? Not that shaped you across the long haul, but really helped you learn to value this person who's on the precipice of retirement, maybe 10 years down the road or whatever, but you know, what are the things that have given you the life you value today?
Well, that's a big question. I grew up in Auburn, 35 miles up the lake with seven brothers and sisters, Roman Catholic household. My father was a doctor. So each one of those words, have significance for who I am and where I came from. Always was a excellent student, but I really struggled behaviorally as I got into my teens. And, you know, I was one of those kids, believe it or not, who might not have made it. I mean, I think most people said, well, he's a number one student or he's a top student. He's definitely going to make it. But
he's
just
smart,
wasn't the case. Yeah. But I wasn't comfortable, and I was finding ways to act out. But I was pretty good at that double life people talk about, where I could still show up, take the test, pretend that I was there, and then, you know, be gone.
Uh-huh. And be gone means?
Well, it initially was just, you know, just not following the rules. I mean, I literally was climbing out the window of my house and spending the nights out, and then crawling back in and pretending I just had a nice night's sleep. You know, really live it in that kind of manipulative world of trying to shape other people's view of me. And finally, I still was able to parlay that through Cornell and then law school. And it was after law school that things kind of came crashing down for me, and I came to terms with the alcohol and drug abuse, which had been going on for since I was 13, and by then I was 28.
Right. And I want to come back to that alcohol and drug abuse, but I want to come back to a kid who has more energy and more smarts than he knows what to do with.
Right.
And then the people around him are willing to really see clearly. Like I had a younger brother who negotiated a deal with the principal. He, as long as he came to school and took tests and made B's or better, he was fine. He could farm or do whatever. He was farming. He was also selling a lot of illegal beer on the side because he looked like he was in about 25 when he was 15.
Yeah.
And because he was a farmer, he could drive. anyway, so he lived that double life, but people kind of kept a bit of a leash on him. But it sounded like you were pushing the boundaries hard.
Yeah, I was. I think it was really hard for my parents because they did not seem to have any effective response, and they had seven other kids. There was a lot going on. Yeah, I was in a lot of leadership roles, so it was. I was an Eagle Scout at 13. I was the. You know,
that's almost impossible.
I know, it's ridiculous. It's you know what it is? If you think about it, it's just someone who's so task-oriented and has the skills to say, this is the task. If you do A to Z, we'll give you this. So I just did A to Z.
You knocked him down. days and weeks.
Yes, right. Yeah. And I actually, at the same time I got that award, I got the Adelantari Day Award, which was the Roman Catholic Scouting Award, which that doesn't happen either. You know, I just was... I had those gifts.
So you reached that peak, and then it fell apart.
Yeah, I was I was like second in my class in ninth grade, and there was 700 in my class. And by 12th grade, and my calculus scores for the year were 90, 80, 70, 60. You know, if you're reading the tea leaves, pretty clear indicators, things were not going well.
Yeah.
They were not going well. And, you know, I headed off to college, and even though I was able to make good grades, things were free falling even worse. Mm-hmm. I was at Holy Cross for a year and a half, and then I left, took a year off, and drove around the country by myself and up to Alaska, spent the year in Alaska. Uh-huh. So a lot of, you know, so much of the of my youth and my behavior was searching for meaning and not feeling connected and looking for connections in kind of all the wrong places.
Right. So what experience changed that?
Well, I had a strong relationship with my wife starting from high school. And
so you've known each other that long.
Yeah, we actually started dating in 11th grade, on and off somewhat during some of these trials and tribulations and travels, but we married at 22. So kind of through the haze, you know, we had a connection that we both thought was really special. So that was important grounding for me. I mean, I brought a lot of important traits to the relationship, and my wife brought a lot of important traits to the relationship that was a good fit for us at the time.
Complementarity.
Very complementary.
Through the addiction, yes. And through the bad behavior.
But then it finally it really fell apart after our first child was born, where then reality was too strong. I was finishing up law school. We had a child. My wife was struggling with postpartum depression, and that was our first what the heck are we really doing here?
Well, you couldn't pull each other through.
We couldn't do it anymore. And that was the beginning of starting to pay attention to my behavior and my impact of my behavior. I feel like I was a bit of the bull in the china shop, or as I say, I was knocking people over on the way to my meditation class. You know, I just was so driven to get someplace else.
Uh-huh.
I really wasn't experiencing my life. I was kind of
Do you understand? I mean, has it come clear over the years what you were driven by?
Well, you know, it's not a
it's not one thing, but
it's not an uncommon experience for people in recovery from addiction. I mean, I certainly had strong genetic background of family members, extended family members who died from alcoholism, and you know, some of them died young. So, I mean, I had that. I mean, I certainly wasn't. I didn't have those feelings because of the nature of my upbringing.
Right.
You know, it was more than that. Somehow, I mean, the combination of where I came from and what I needed and my history brought me to that place.
Mm-hmm. So, let's just what child. A new child, right. A wife who's postpartum depression, and you're finishing law school, and you've got law boards looking you down the face, and so how does the wake up call? What does it look like?
Well, it was so much of me trying to do everything. I thought I was responsible for everything, so that I had to both take care of my wife, take care of the baby, start a new career, And that made me a very miserable person. I was very unhappy by that point. And I actually started kind of unraveling my own story by looking into where I came from and the use, the alcoholism in my family background. But I finally got to the point where I need help. Mm-hmm. I need to get some help. And I actually love telling the story because I went to a therapist and who I knew was qualified in substance abuse. And I said to her, I'm here because I've got five problems that I need help with. I need help with my mother, my father, my boss, my wife, and my son. And I was serious. Like, those were the kind of the barriers to my happiness.
Well, they were identifiable, discrete relationships.
Yes, and they were... emotionally, you know, they all had their challenges, and it's like, oh, would you just go away? I love the fact that today those would all be the top of my list of the most valuable things in my life. And they were then too. Right. I just didn't understand it.
They were just problems. They were so valuable they hurt. So how did the therapist help you reframe?
It was really interesting because I suggested to her that we should do a drug and alcohol evaluation. And so she said, fine, you know, tell me your story. So for two sessions.
So how did you know to make that suggestion?
I don't really know.
Because you're precocious in a whole lot of ways.
Yeah, I guess I just sensed, I didn't have any belief that I had a problem, but I had a sense that I needed, that was the source of something. And I had looked for her particularly because of that. And I just, for two sessions, I just told her the truth. I absolutely told her my life story, my relationship with alcohol and drugs. And in the third session, she read it back to me and she said, I can't help you. You know, you need to go out to the self-help community and get some support from your peers. And it was shocking to me. And I don't even know where that came from for her, because even if that was appropriate, there's no reason why I couldn't have done therapy as well.
Right.
But somehow that was her conclusion, and it was my turning point.
Yeah. Well, she threw the problem back in your lap.
Yeah, she certainly did.
She didn't become an identified fixer.
That's true. And I was already, you know, kind of a little crush on her. I mean, I was like, we kind of got a good thing going here, don't we? You know, and it's so funny that it was like, no. This isn't where the problem gets addressed.
Right. Right. Well, what you describe is also a larger part of the a challenge in the fabric of our sense of society and community. We have almost no community, and within the 12-step programs or the addiction programs, there are real communities.
Absolutely.
But they've kind of come up as supports to what's not working well in society. Community is a little different than that, but right. They get at it really close.
Yeah. Well, they certainly. I mean, the things that I was lacking. That I needed were honesty, because I was shading everything in an effort to reinforce the self that I was trying to portray, and I had to break through all of that and stop earning my keep every moment, every breath. You know, I just was
justifying yourself,
myself constantly with no sense of what I actually needed. And being with people who were on that same journey and were breaking through that was the beginning of really finding a family, finding a community that met my needs.
Right, right. And families are institutions in a way. They sit between community and other organizations and institutions. But institutions, we don't often get the truth because people want to control us or manage us for their organizational
right.
purposes or
sure.
their institutional purposes, and it becomes a little coercive, or it becomes codependent, and those are nasty things. But where you have no obligations to each other in a
right.
true community,
yes.
you can speak the truth, and it's just there. There's you didn't take it, leave it, whatever. And you're and each of us are right and wrong in the truths we speak. It's a mixed bag.
And it's such a journey to kind of unravel all that I brought to it, all that we all bring to it, and get to the point where it's like, oh, you're angry at me. Well, I get to make a decision about whether or not I'm going to take that on. I mean, where I came from, I was so reactive. It's like, you direct negativity towards me, I'm going to come over twice as much on top. And, you know, finally slowing down the experience to start just being here, being honest, taking our turns. There's my wife and I do a lot of have a lot of tools in our recovery, in our coupleship, where we only one person speaks, and then when they're done, the other person speaks. And while one of speaking, the other person's job is not to get down your list for cross examination or your grievances. It's to listen. Your only job is to listen, hear what the other person's saying. But I didn't have those skills.
No,
a long time.
And the thing about most families and most institutions and organizations is the law of any reaction produces an equal and opposite
yes,
immediate reaction.
Right.
You know, and when you're outside of that directly linked force, you can just be.
Yeah, and I think that's where I'm, what I'm working on.
Yeah, yeah. So let's cut to music, and then we're going to come back to some of these themes. What should we play next?
We've got a couple more good choices. Let's try Wharf Rat since we're talking about recovery a bit.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest is John Rowley. And John, you have just played two very interesting songs, and we didn't remember to talk about the first one. But how do we make the move from Everything is Broken to Wharf Rat?
Yeah, well, it's kind of the complexity of our lives. I didn't have, for a long time, a sense of holding multiple feelings at the same time. It was always, you know, all of one or all of another. It's actually much more complicated than that. And a lot these days just depends on where you want to put your attention. You know, it's like, well, if I want to look over here, if I could look at this political scene, how high do I want my blood pressure to go? Or I could look over here and you know, so.
Or how deep do you want your sadness to go?
Well, that's it. I mean, because it's available to you instantly at your fingertips, yeah, as many times as you want to, and I am deeply emotional in that way, and I like I like feeling deeply emotional because it is a feeling of being alive, but it's not a place for me to hang out.
Yeah, yeah, and being able to feel contradictory emotions, you know, it's on one level it's paradoxical or it's
yes,
it's but on another level it's hypocritical, and it's all those things, and we are.
And so everything is broken. It's kind of like a, I mean, I just love Dylan, and I love his poetry, and I love his music, and I always have. But the, I mean, the images and the concept, like, there are so many things that are not right with this world. And he does a wonderful job of just, you know, holding them up and bashing them and showing them to us. And yet, this is what we got.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it's broken. I mean, who would say, oh, our political system, it's running great, it's doing great, you know, we're doing great with all these decisions, you know, our environmental stuff is great. No, everything feels like it's broken sometimes, and yet here we are. So yeah. That's kind of the challenge. And then the Wharf Rat part of it, I just, again, that's a deeply emotional song of kind of the hopeless alcoholic fading, and yet it's so easy for us to judge that, and we see, oh, look at that guy, you know, what a loser. You look at him pushing his grocery cart around. In fact, you know, this guy's got a whole life and dreams and things that has happened to him, and he ultimately, the song itself becomes a real hopeful song of recovery for deadheads and for, you know, other music fans.
Yeah, no, and you can hold on to multiple realities at
right,
once.
That's right.
One time I made the mistake of, this was in 1981 or 80 or whenever, we were driving into New York City in my future father-in-law's car, and I said of the homeless man on the side of the street, I really wonder what life looks like from that man's perspective, because I am just deeply curious about all people.
Right.
And it just floored him. He's an analyst on Wall Street, and, you know, do a crunch of numbers on companies and stuff like that. And this future son-in-law is wondering the world looks like from somebody who's probably addicted and definitely homeless.
Yeah, but that's the world I come from too, though. So I became an attorney. I was a criminal defense attorney. Then I got additional jobs, but I within the legal profession. But I had a very difficult time with that level of partisanship. Just not good. There's a role in all of the professions, but there's a role as a defense attorney where I just wasn't comfortable with. I see the big picture, and I appreciate what's going on all around, and I had a hard time just being arguing the partisan side to it. I think that's what attracted me to the judiciary in the first place. And I was lucky to get appointed in 1996 to city court, so I was able to get out of that partisanship pretty quickly.
Sure, sure. And that was the very reason I chose not to go to law school, because I would not participate in that conflict-driven system when we needed to be making peace.
And I think that I think it was a real conflict for me as well. I didn't come to it easily. I was actually working with schizophrenics in a group home just after graduating from Cornell, just kind of lost, just kind of
sure,
living.
Sure.
And it's during the Reagan administration, and my clients, who were very impaired, were getting hammered by the Social Security disability rulings that the Reagan administration, because they changed the rules. So I went to a two-day training to explain to us how we as advocates could help outsmart this. And a very charismatic lawyer did the presentation for 2 days and just dissected the law. For example, he told us that if our clients take the bus to the examination, they're going to get dinged for their level of independence, those kind of things. And it so angered me and fascinated me that I then ended up I actually applied to school for the joint degree program or in the mental health field, law and social policy. So that's how I started down that road and then stumbled along.
I like where I ended up. No, and so the question I would like to ask is, you know, how have you changed in ways that you would not have anticipated or chosen? And while you think about that, let me make an announcement about one of the reasons for the timing of this conversation is that on November the 19th at 3 p.m. at St. Catherine of Siena Church, there is a multi-faith community-wide Thanksgiving service. And John Rowley will join Santosh Nainan and address the issue of finding gratitude in times of addiction. And that, you know, when we coined that title, a lot of people see that as paradoxical, sure, or impossible, but that is a part of the story. So 3 p.m. Sunday afternoon, November 19th at St. Catherine of Siena Church up at 302 St. Catherine Circle in Northeast Ithaca, there will be a service, and John will be speaking there along with Santosh and others.
Really looking forward to that. I think it's a very a humbling and challenging assignment, but I'm really looking forward to it. I love the concept, and I love your reference back to looking for peace in community. And there's no greater example, I think, of coming together with from all of our different perspectives. Right. Right. I've always been that way. I don't know where that came from. When I left Holy Cross and was looking for some place to go, I landed at Cornell and I loved it. There were so many languages. There were so many countries represented. Somehow that just appealed to me. And I just have that kind of sensitivity. I think that as to your question for what's changed.
And it may not relate to this. It may not relate to what we've talked about. Yes. Thus
no,
far.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I was so, I didn't understand my drivenness. I didn't have tolerance for being quiet. And, it was both, a skill and maybe, a bit of a problem. I mean, I would take over every organization that I joined, and they would hand the reins to me because I projected such competence.
Right, and you were competent.
I mean, and I was good. I was good at it for the most part, but I guess
but
what I didn't...
But it's not your job to be good at
it. And I think that's what I most didn't see coming was how much becoming quiet and taking the world off my shoulders, how important that would be to who I became.
I want to share with you a poem by Archie Ammons. The burdens of the world on my back lighten the world not a whit, while removing them reduces greatly my specific gravity.
That's exactly it. And it was one of the early insights that I got when I got into recovery was I just didn't know. I just didn't realize. I was like trained to do that. It's like being a killing machine or something. I was a helping machine. And so now it's interesting, now that I'm 17 years in county court and family court, and I have a lot of leadership and I have leadership, programs that I lead, it's still important to me to make a difference, to have an impact, to try to build community. But it has to fundamentally shift. I have to recognize my limits. I have to recognize the value in other points of view, and I really enjoyed growing that way.
Uh-huh. So, what was the substance use about? Was it not recognizing your limits, or how did it relate to this?
Well, the way that I think about use is, it really is got a suicidal aspect to it because it was so. Intense. It was like, let's go. We're going all the way. Let's get out of here. It was very self-destructive. It was never social. It certainly had a lot of anxiety. I carried a lot of social anxiety and all the anxieties that anybody as a teenager carries. But I liked almost getting to the point of unconsciousness. I wanted to forget, and yet I wasn't coming from a traumatized place, so I don't have a good explanation for it. I just know when I think about it, I think about hard,
If you were going to become an Eagle Scout fast, if you were going to get the church award fast,
yeah, right.
you're going to drink and drug hard and fast.
It's true. It was almost to the point of, if you're having one, I'm having two. And, which was not a good choice.
Yeah. For me, when I've used alcohol, when I've misused alcohol, it's about numbing. And if it goes beyond numbing, then that's scary.
Well, that's definitely what I was doing. I was checking out of my emotional world. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It was, they talk about not being comfortable in your own skin. I just wanted to stop feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you've, okay. And so how has this process of stepping back on the drive helped you to become more comfortable in your own skin? Maybe that's not the right question.
No, well, it certainly describes kind of my path, where slowing down and taking better care of myself, you know, then all sorts of different things can happen. I things that I'm certain of, I'm not certain of anymore. Quick judgments no longer, I can't hold them. I mean, I had experience recently with a person that I'd known fairly well for a couple of years and had not a negative opinion of him, but, you know, didn't see a lot of value in him. He's, you know, good sense of humor. That was about it. And then I had an opportunity to hear his story, you know, at length, a long version of it. And I was so changed by that and so attracted to him. It was once again that, oh my God, you know nothing. You know nothing about other people. And this whole, what he was projecting, you know, was the front for incredible hurt and sensitivity, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. wonder, you know, wonderful things, things that were very appealing, you know, once I got there. So I just can't move past like that. Like I always have, I got this all sized up. I know who the people are. They're going to help me get where I want to go. I know the people that are in the way. I know the people I don't have to worry about. You know, that's not a way to live.
Probably the most important line I learned maybe in my 30s, I can be very wrong.
Well, I think that good leadership is all about that. It took a long time before I even thought about apologizing and taking responsibility. And of course, these days, I mean, amends and acknowledgement of errors is an extremely important part. And I can remember as that was developing, it was like, I'd recognize, oh yeah, I'm wrong, but I sure as heck don't want to admit it. And then, you know, then trying to narrow the gap of how long it took me to own that. Right. And, you know, the acceptance of humanness is so important for that being here, being mm-hmm. right now. It's like hitting the wrong button on the radio. It's like, yeah, every day. I mean, in fact, one of the lines I liked was, I look forward to the mistakes I'll make today. I mean, there's a spiritual challenge.
Because they will humble me.
Yeah.
They'll keep me right-sized in the world.
That's exactly what it is, and that's what I think we miss so much of, with these expectations that everything will be great, everything's going to be grand, and it's just everything's broken.
Yeah, you brought four pieces of music, and we are going to close with one, but there's this second one, which is it takes us from humility to horror.
Yes.
And shall we play it now?
Yes.
It's Nina Simone's rendition of Strange Fruit.
7 feet barren, strange fruit, blood on the leaves. And blood at the roots. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant South. Them big bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. Scent of magnolia. Clean and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. trees of fruit. For the crows to pluck. For the rain to gather. For the wind to suck. For the sun to rot. For the leaves to drop.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is John Rowley. So, John, why this song?
I think that it's essential that when we talk about our community, our society, that we recognize the powerful history, the incredible inequities, and these are affecting us. I mean, we're talking about, if we talk about slavery and the impact of slavery and lynchings and the like, I mean, we're dealing with this every day. We're dealing with, black men making, you know, one-tenth on average of white men. Or I think it was the last unemployed high school graduates white and college graduates black are making about the same amount of money. On average, I mean, there is so much inequity in our society, and as much as we've tried to address it, we've really failed in many, many ways. And I see the impact of that. We all see the impact of that, but I certainly see it in the courts every day.
Mm-hmm. So, how can you say more about how you respond when you see it in the courts, or the way in which it becomes apparent to you, or how you make it apparent to others?
Yeah, well, it's so challenging because the frustration of the denial of the impact of racism in our culture is just, you know, it drives me crazy. I mean, how many measures do you need? How many ways do you need to look at it? But I have to deal with it in a very challenging way. And in fact, the most challenging work that I do as a judge is sentencing, because there's only typically two judges in Tompkins County that can send people to prison, and it's the two county court judges. So everybody who goes to prison is coming, you know, through our courts. And it's very it's sad, it's tragic, and it's also part of the function. But by that point, you know, we've exhausted what limited options we have, and now we're just imposing consequences without any real belief that change will happen.
Because where you are sending them is not set up for that change, and the way it's led up is your hands are tied.
And I tell you,
your hands tied.
Exactly. I've started doing more reading of looking at prison systems in other countries, looking at comparative sentencing, and that may not be recommended reading for judges. I mean, there are some remarkably progressive ideas and societies that are doing things so differently. Now, I'm required, and I think this is a good thing as part of my job, to visit all of the institutions which I can send people to, from mental health facilities to juvenile detention facilities to maximum security prisons. So I go to these places, I think it's every 4 years. So I know what they look like, and I talk to the staff. And actually, I talk to...
Do you talk to people you've sent there?
I do, whenever I can. And I tell you, my first concern is their safety. I'm always interested in knowing how safe they felt. And I have to say that most people who come out, at least of the shorter end, come out focused on trying to do things different. Now, I don't know that the experience gave them what they need to do things different, but they at least don't want to go back there and don't come to me, you know, talking about horrific abuses or that kind of a thing, which makes me feel a little bit better.
Yeah. Is this reading this research anything that you can bring into the system to try to impact or influence how changes might happen in the future? Or is this more for your peace of knowing that something could be different and maybe when you're retired it becomes an option?
No, it's everywhere. Yeah. It's everything. I mean, the most direct place is with the family treatment court that I preside over, where we are intervening with families often at birth of a child, because we know that big things have happened by the time a child is 1 year old, or even before they're born, there can be big things that have happened.
Sure.
And improving the quality of that and giving support to families as early as we identify their distress, that'll pay off for our community.
And that early, and you have a lot more discretion.
A lot more discretion. And we've just got a $2 million grant over the next 5 years that will kind of our wish list. What do we wish we could do more for families? And we're now really going to be able to expand our impact on the community in ways that, will pay off.
Yeah. The way we normally close this show is I'm gonna switch gears here just a bit.
Sure.
And this is, what do you do to take care of yourself emotionally, intellectually, and physically throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis? And how do you know you need to do something? I mean, this has been behind all of our conversation
Sure.
today, but to be explicit.
Yeah, I think that turning point for me was the beginning of self-awareness, of just not even paying attention to how I was impacting others, how I was impacting myself. So I think I have a lot of self-awareness now. I'll notice it in the courtroom. I stopped drinking coffee 6 months ago because I decided if I was going to be irritable, I'm going to do it organically. And I think that's good because it does happen on occasion. I'm really committed. I work very hard at taking care of myself. I see therapists as necessary. I've been in and out of counseling for years. I have hobbies that absorb me. I'm a beekeeper now, and I think now that I'm 5 or 6 years into it, I have enough of a skill that it is really kind of a zen. When I'm out there with the bees, I'm completely lost in that world. There's no anxiety, mm-hmm. no concern.
No
I'm
intrusive
just doing
thoughts.
That.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
And it's such a passion and such enjoyment.
Uh-huh,
So I get lost in that way. We walk every day. We've got dogs, 4 dogs still, and have a very close relationship with Jean. And we spend a lot of time together. Mm-hmm. And we also relax a lot. We are big, Netflix, and we're always down those crazy roads. I'm the one who has limitations there. I'm the one who says, no, that's it. We're not watching another one. I got to go to sleep. I'm
no
very committed to sleep.
Yeah.
I'm very committed to a good night's sleep and to a healthy diet. I've gone back to a vegetarian diet. I was vegetarian for 15 years, or one son still is, and I've just gone back to it recently. It just is more tuned with me.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
And I just feel better with it. I feel good. But that emotional health is extremely important. I do not want to be abusing people. I don't want, when I get angry and when I act out, I've hurt people and I've hurt myself. And so I'm really trying to be very careful about that.
Right. Anger as a signal is not necessarily a bad thing, but anger is a tool.
Yeah, well,
is it different?
It is true. There are certainly times where anger, even expression of it, is appropriate, where it's important. But it really is the signal that I've tried to pay attention to, the urgency that I start to feel. I didn't used to have space in that urgency, and I've made a lot of progress. I feel like I've had the gift of patience bestowed on me in recent months and years in a way that I never had it before, to not engage. Because I'm in the presence of so much conflict, and I want to be separate from that.
you want to be present to it and not controlled by it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have two really angry, very aggressive attorneys that are really battling each other. I want to make sure that I haven't been triggered until then I just, right. you know, do the judge Simplify. Thing instead. I mean, I had one recently where I was about to go out of town and these two were really going at it. And I said, I'm going out of town at the end of the day today. Nothing you do is going to disturb my peace of mind. Just giving them notice. You know? if they're trying to get me going, they're not going to.
I want to just explore something briefly. You've been given the gift of kind of not reacting or the peace.
Right.
And is that a fruit of having taken responsibility for self-care? Or is that something that just happens as the process unfolds?
Well, it certainly, I wouldn't have articulated it as a goal, maybe as a wish, but I think it developed kind of naturally as part of the process because it's what was next. I mean, how do I feel satisfied if I'm not sitting still and taking account and taking responsibility? You know, how do I then, you know, activate to try to reach out? Mm-hmm. So it's all part of a development process, I think.
So, and were these, I want to know if these two things were linked or if they were somewhat separate. And the awareness that the addiction was a damaging thing in your life. And the other piece is, when did you realize it's your job to care for yourself?
Well, it is a strong, it's an essential part of recovery, especially for someone like me who did not do a good job of taking care of myself. And you just start, you know, I love when I see new people. It's like, well, what are you doing to take care of yourself? It's like, what do you mean by that? What do you mean that? Well, what time do you have for yourself? What do you mean by that? You know, so I went from having no concept to, I think it's still a challenge. I mean, it happens with my grown-up sons and my wife. I'll make promises to all three, which are conflicting promises.
Right.
You know, I love to be able to do all of those things, but I can't. And so I still have to, you know, acknowledge my limitations. And it just, it's a lot of it. So why is it so hard?
That's the mistake you made today.
That's right. That is the mistake. It's like, why, you know, I was working out on the track last night after dark, and I was wishing my wife would realize how much trouble I was having. Finally, in desperation, I called her and said, I need help. And it's like, why is it so hard? Why did that take so long?
Yeah, well, I mean,
but I did.
I know the issue on some level. I wish they could read my mind, but they can't.
Yeah. So, you know, just asking for what I need, it's huge progress. Just directly saying, you know, I'm feeling distressed. I'm feeling overwhelmed. I need help. If we could do more of that, we'd all be better.
Yeah, and it's not a blemish on your character to need help.
It's the greatest challenge with our drug courts to convince. I don't think you can really convince people of it. They have to experience it. Uh-huh. They have to finally come in when they're full of trying, you know, of shame and trying to hide, and then take a risk because they trust somebody now, and then find out how much relief they can get. And you can't really give that to people. They really have to experience it.
Right, right. In a very different way, but I want to make a connection here. I used to have this rule of thumb. I won't allow volunteers to serve other people in really direct ways unless they've asked for help themselves in some significant way in their lives. Because they will not know how to be in that awkwardness. And that's a very, very, what you have said is really, really important.
Well, that I think that's a fascinating perspective. We are about to hire two peer support specialists, two people who will be just kind of freelance supporting our families.
Which is what families often need.
Which, you know, it's just like, well, I can't really say it, but, you know, and they will be, there is a requirement that they have substantial recovery. And it's kind of like, you got to do the work before you can offer the hand.
That's right.
Otherwise, it does get all confused. It can get confused anyhow, but it gets all confused.
Right. And just to go back to this service on November the 19th, gratitude for learning what you didn't know you needed to learn and for living the fruit of it,
yes,
is huge. It's really huge.
I couldn't be happier with where I am in my life, with all of the things, everything being broken, with all of our history, with all of our inequity. I've got what I got, and I'm trying to bring it.
Right. And you bring it without resentment and without excessive judgment to people who don't know what they're going to experience.
Yeah,
from
that's the challenge. Yeah. I try to, especially in the courtroom where, it's about respect. It's public service. It doesn't always happen that way for everybody who has been there.
Right, right. John, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
I really appreciate the opportunity.
You brought one last song. Do you want to speak to it now, or do you?
Yes, let me just comment on it for a second. I did select Fortune Teller by Alison Krauss and Robert Plant. You probably have figured out who wrote that. Because I don't know, but the I wanted to make sure that I ended with some of the magic and the unknowns and the wonder. I've just always loved this song and the beauty of it too. It's a beautiful song.
Here we go.
Went to the fortune teller, had my fortune read. I didn't know what to tell her. I had a dizzy feeling in my head. She took a look at my palm. She said, "Son, you feel kind of warm." She looked into a crystal ball. She said, "You're in love."
Told for free.